Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. Welcome to season two, book two. My name is John.
Hey yo, I'm JP.
And I am super excited to introduce season two's book. You guys helped us pick. Thank you so much to everyone who voted. And we're going to be going through The Pragmatic Programmer. This is written by Andy Hunt and Dave Thomas.
Super exciting. And even the full title is The Pragmatic Programmer: From Journeyman to Master. So it's one of those.
Yeah, and this is one of those books that I have seen on the shelves and like everyone has recommended to me at some point, and I've actually never read it. And digging into this book, I'm so excited to share everything that we've got to talk through in this book, and the format is super different. I'm super excited to go through this stuff.
Yeah, same here. And what's cool about this is that it's not so much like a textbook like Domain-Driven Design was. It's more they're like little tapas of little bits and pieces of nice little advice for just programming in general. You don't have to be a Ruby programmer or a functional programmer, an object-oriented programmer. It's just for, you know, little tips for the programmer.
Yeah, and they're super code agnostic, at least so far, up to like the middle of chapter two that I've read to thus far. Everything is not necessarily, it's not at all talking about a language or a framework, and it's not very technical. I feel like we got a little bit wonky at times with Domain-Driven Design, although there were so many great insights and it was such a great book overall. I think a couple episodes, I was like, man, this is getting really technical and tough to keep super relatable, like immediately relatable right now. And I love how immediate all this stuff is. And I don't want to keep belaboring the point of how excited we are to jump in. I do want to just start jumping in. So do we want to introduce the book? You've got a big quote here that introduces the book. I think that's probably a good one.
Yeah. Let me read it. But I also want to, as I keep belaboring this point, what I think is really cool is that each little section has these exercises, which are really cool to talk through because it like challenges you to think about these tips and to place yourself in the shoes of these hypothetical scenarios. So that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to dive into a nice little quote to kick this book off. And what you need to keep in mind also is that this book was written in 1999 and I was seven. So if you want to do the math on how old I am, it's 2018. Pretty crazy how like all of these topics are just like still super, super relevant. And I think it's going to be fun. Okay. So here's the quote. As a programmer, you are part listener, part advisor, part interpreter, and part dictator. You try to capture elusive requirements and find a way of expressing them so that a mere machine can do them justice. You try to document your work so that others can understand it, and you try to engineer your work so that others can build on it. What's more, you try to do all of this against the relentless ticking of the project clock. You work small miracles every day. End quote. I read that and I was like, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah, I work small miracles every day. That's awesome. That like really solidifies, like, I don't know, it just makes you feel good about yourself as a programmer.
Yeah, I feel like you need to be in front of an American flag made of like ASCII art, saying that with like dramatic music under it. Like, that's how I read it. It was so genuinely inspiring that someone like understands the daily struggle and the things that I have to do every day as a programmer. And I love the work, but it is really challenging capturing these crazy, such elusive requirements and expressing them, just the way that he was able to distill that into being a miracle worker. I was like, yeah, like I was like so ready to keep jumping into it. So let's talk a little bit about, like, they're introducing in this preface, like, what is a pragmatic programmer? What does this mean? What makes a pragmatic programmer? You want to walk us through those?
Yeah. So there are like five characteristics. So the five characteristics of a pragmatic programmer, and keep in mind, this is all just like the preface of the book, just to like get you a little taste of what's going on. So these are the five characteristics. One, a pragmatic programmer is an early adopter / fast adapter. Two, a pragmatic programmer is inquisitive. You ask a lot of questions. Three, you're a critical thinker. Four, you're realistic. You know, you're realistic about deadlines and expectations. And five, you're a jack of all trades. Yeah, so those are the five characteristics of a pragmatic program. That gives like a nice little taste of what the book's going to be about.
Yeah, and the word pragmatic, I was like, that's not one I use in my everyday language every day, but it comes from the Latin pragmaticus, or skilled in business, which itself is derived from the Greek meaning to do. So it's about doing things. It's about like really practically getting down and dirty, shipping code, shipping projects. It's very like action-based, the idea of being a pragmatic programmer. And it's a lot of it feels very like startup-y and exciting and bootstrappy to me, which is just like, ship stuff, care about what you do. And just the introduction of this book, what it's setting up is just helping you be a more pragmatic programmer, helping you be someone who's action-based, who's an early adopter, who's always learning. I feel like you have that when you first start, but as you like get through the daily grind as a programmer, it's easy to lose some of these elements of a pragmatic programmer. And I feel like these tips that they go through in the book is a really just an exciting way to get you back into it and get you excited about your craft all over again.
Oh, totally. I think re-sparking that like excitement about programming, something you just touched upon right now, is like really what this book brought to me. Cause you know, you just like you said, it's like a daily grind. And so don't get me wrong, I love programming. I literally do this every day by choice on the weekends, all day, every day. But sometimes it does feel like a daily grind. And I think this book can sort of like lighten the mood and like inspire you again and like really remind you why you love to do what you do, which is writing software.
Yeah, absolutely. And the format of this book is super cool. Basically, it's just a bunch of tips and then they expound on the tips. So the total body of tips that we're going to go through in the next few episodes here is just 70 tips, start to finish. And each tip has like immediate action points. And so really with that, I think we should just jump into chapter one, which is the first 10 tips of being a pragmatic programmer.
Yeah. So we're going to go through the first 10 today. Do you want to kick it off with number one?
Heck yeah, absolutely. So tip number one is care about your craft. That's tip number one. There's a lot of really like super inspiring quotes from different people under these tips. And this one, I don't remember who said it, but the quote was, quote, "We who cut mere stones must always be envisioning cathedrals." And it's like from these like 1612 stone cutters. And it was like the stonecutter mason group. And these guys, they are toiling literally for generations. It's like my grandfather was cutting these stones. My father was cutting these stones. And I am cutting these stones for the same cathedral. And you know, the quote is, "We who are cutting the stones must always be envisioning cathedrals." And I think that they cared the amount of craftsmanship in that era. And it's hard to compare like my little web app to a cathedral in the 1600s. But at the same time, like I really deeply care about my projects. And when I'm sitting there trying to solve this one, you know, for loop and this one little piece of code that I'm stuck on, I'm trying to envision the final project. I'm trying to envision the big picture of what I'm building and really care about my craft and what I'm doing. And am I doing this one small piece of it? You know, am I cutting this one brick for this cathedral as well as I can? Am I honing my craft of what I'm doing as a stone cutter?
Yeah, I think, oh man, I mean, I really love all these tips and I'm probably going to say that tons and tons of times, but I think it speaks volumes, you know, because, you know, they have terms, there's terms out there like code monkey, or sometimes you'll be on like Stack Overflow and people are ranting about how like, you know, web developers just, you know, ship out CRUD apps. But, you know, like it's more than that, like it's a craft and it's more than just like being a code monkey and shipping CRUD apps and writing crappy code and just shipping stuff, you know, because then like it doesn't really feel like a craft. It just feels like something you do and then you don't care about it.
Yeah.
But it really just reminds you like, Every line of code you write is part of your craft. You know, you are an artist of sorts. You are a craftsperson and you're making something that's like really cool and really awesome, you know?
Yeah, I think it's easy to forget that we are craftspeople. And that's really what we are as modern day craftspeople. And yeah, I don't think we're necessarily in the same level as artists or musicians, but I think that we're in the corner of the bubble of the Venn diagram, I think, and it's definitely related. And I definitely have more of an artistic and a music and an arts background. And I love how much all of that, like the daily practice, the science and balancing the technical skills with the creative side. I feel like there's a lot in our craft that there is very creative, obviously. Even when you're just talking about being a back-end web developer, there's a lot of balancing art and science and communication and communicating these specifications. That's essentially what it was saying before, it as eloquently as possible. There's something to that that is a craft and it is balancing the art and science. And then there's the whole design side of things, which we could argue forever that there is more art there than science too. But I think on both sides, it's this awesome balance between art and science. And I think that's what makes it so addicting for me. It's like you're solving interesting problems as creatively as possible all day long. And that's makes me want to care more about software and what I'm doing and trying to be better at my craft.
Let me pose a question to you, because I think a lot of discussion can be had with even just like each one of these tips is when is like a time that you noticed that you were sort of neglecting the craft? Or can you think of a time where you weren't considering the craft in mind while you were writing software?
Yeah, I think number one is deadlines, whether it be financial or time. So it's like, you know, I promised this feature for X amount of dollars and I'm looking at my hours and I'm like, oh shit, I'm at $12 an hour right now. Like I can't take the time to refine this further, even though I know that the code is bad because, you know, I quoted this as a fixed price and I just like, I can't keep eating into my quote unquote hourly pay by continuing to invest in this. And then the second thing is time. It's like having a limited amount of time to be able to dedicate something is when it often gets compromised. I think those are the two most common for me. What about you? When do you kind of find that your craft is becoming compromised?
Yeah, those are really good ones. Not like good ones. It's obviously not a good thing.
Yeah, it's tensions to have to manage. Yeah, because I feel like sometimes we can get so hung up on the fact that time is limited and money is limited. But like, let's be real. We have to ship stuff. And I think that there is a fine balance between being action focused and getting it in the world. But it's hard to find that balance between resources and craftsmanship. It's really hard to balance those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another time that I sort of like, not necessarily neglect my craft, but sometimes I have to remind myself, like, this is your craft. Like, you need to like master these things is when I find myself not wanting to learn new technologies or like just even not just learn new technologies, but revisit the basics, like understand recursion, because, you know, the first time you learn recursion, like it hurts. And sometimes you don't understand like the stack trace and you're not willing to understand how an algorithm works. And so sometimes I catch myself like just saying, oh, screw it. Like, I'll just move on. Like, I don't need to, like, when am I ever going to write a recursive algorithm for a web app? Which, by the way, I have done, you know, so it does happen. But there are those moments where you're just like, screw it, I'll just move on. Like, I don't need to know this. But then like you remind yourself, like I have to remind myself in those moments, like, you know, if you really care about software, these are those struggles are the ones that you'll push through and really like care to master.
Yeah.
I think even in those moments, it's important to like remember, like, it's not just, you're not just like a code monkey.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think this whole first one about caring about your craft is super broad. And I think it will carry on over into like the other tips, because I feel like a lot of the other tips that we're going to get into in just a second like also reflect this idea about like caring about your craft.
Absolutely. Even this second one, tip two, you want to jump us into that one?
Yeah, it's a good segue. So tip two is think about your work, never run on autopilot. And so this little section talked about, there's a little story or a metaphor, an allegory, you know, one of those little just like a nice way to kick off this section. And it was basically the story about a really big lawn that was like super, super pristine, like the greenest and most crisp lawn you've ever seen in your life. So someone had asked basically like the maintainer of it, like, how do you keep this like amazing lawn like perfect and just green? And the guy basically says, oh, dude, every morning all I do is like wipe the dew off and that's it. And he's like, what? He's like, is that really it?
Well, he's like, I mow it once a week. I water it daily and I just kind of wipe the dew off. Like, it seems so easy.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, is that it? You just do those things like once a month? Like, that's nothing. And he was like, yeah, you do that for decades and you have a lawn just like mine. And I was like, right. Oh, that's the kicker right there.
The answer was like 227 years and then you have a lawn that looks like this. It's like that regular investment in maintenance. Uh-huh. Yeah, and it talked about this concept of, I don't know how to say this, but it's a Japanese word, Kaizen?
I think it's Kaizen. I might be butchering it too.
Yeah, which is this concept of continuous small improvements. And one of my favorite quotes that I've ever read is, try to be 1% better every single day and you'll be 365% better every year.
I like that.
And I love that idea. And it's the same concept of just like the daily maintenance and investment, just the very small things that you do. If you learn one small thing, but have that consistency over time, it's just a very, very powerful concept. And I've seen it even in my life, even just going from, you know, I was working full time and I transitioned into being a programmer just by daily, every morning, just spending an hour and a half, like waking up super early and just starting to invest in it slowly, building that portfolio. And like, I looked up and after 2 years of hard, consistent work, I was a programmer overnight.
Just like that. I'm just kidding. It's that easy.
Just like that.
You just do it every single day for 200 years and you'll be the best programmer.
Exactly.
What I like about this second tip about like never running on autopilot and like thinking about what you're doing and like Kaizen and like little improvements is that's also like a really good way to approach a code base that has zero test coverage. Because you see, you see like a code base with tens of thousands of lines with zero coverage. You run that, you know, you run your test suite and the percentage is like 1%, which is basically like the generated tests. There's like one test file in there, and you just think to yourself, like, how am I ever going to approach this? And the answer is obviously to not tackle it all at once, you know, like just every now and then get a little bit of coverage and soon enough you'll be there. Like, I think this speaks volumes towards like having patience and just little tiny improvements and you'll eventually get there. It's not going to all happen overnight. You know, Rome wasn't built overnight. So that's sort of like what I took away from this. And it's really cool, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So tip three is provide options. Don't make lame excuses. Ooh. Basically, this tip was just take responsibility. When something can't be done, explain what can be done to salvage the situation. And I liked this one, how practical it was, which is like when you're running late on a deadline. I feel like so many times I come into a project and because I do freelance work. So I work with a lot of people who have worked with other developers. And oftentimes I'm the guy who gets called when they're finally willing to make the investment to maybe do things right. Or I have been at times called in to like clean up a mess and fix things. And I feel like as especially web developers, there's just this thing of like never responding and making excuses and not hearing from them from 2 weeks. And I feel like developers and designers, especially freelance, have this reputation of just being very, always having excuses and never responding. And when something breaks, never having a good reason for it. And just being like, oh, it's going to be late by 3 weeks. And I like this idea of provide options, don't make excuses. So don't say, you know, this is going to be 3 weeks later than we thought. Say, I can have it for you tomorrow, but these are the five compromises we're going to make to get that live tomorrow. Or I can have it live in 3 days, but these are the five compromises. Or, you know, if you want it on time, I need to, you know, source with another developer and it's going to cost more money if we can do that. Of course, we want to stick to our commitments, which is actually a future tip. But in general, it's like, give some options here. Like, what are some ways that you can solve this? Don't just make excuses.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's such thing as like a good excuse? Like, is an option a good excuse, or is an option literally like something else, like a different avenue?
Yeah, I think that especially in my context, and oftentimes it's like you have a client, whether it's internal or whether you're a freelancer or not, and they need what they can do. Like, they need what the options are. They don't necessarily care what happened. That might be like the later, they want to understand more under the hood what happened, but they want to know like A, B, or C, what can we do about it now? So I don't think a good excuse is a good excuse in this context. I think if something's broken or something needs to go live, they need options to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, there's always that like compromise. Cause I'm just thinking about the times where I'm taking longer than expected to ship a feature. And like, it's never, there's like, I guess you're right. There's no one wants to hear an excuse, period. Even if it's a good excuse, like my test suite kept breaking and I don't know what's causing these bugs. And I've been hunting bugs for 8 hours. They're gonna be like, I don't care. So, you know, maybe what the approach is to something like that, where like, you know, it's not like you weren't working. It's just that you couldn't get something to work perhaps. And so maybe the excuse is like, hey, look, we can just ship this feature. And, you know, you try to spin it in such a way that like, at the very least, we'll be able to get an MVP out into our client's hands or into users' hands so we can get like better feedback versus like, sorry, I just couldn't get it done.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me of? I had a client where we were putting in just a Stripe payment collection because initially it was completely handled offline. So they were sending PayPal invoices to collect money for people to be on the platform. And they're like, hey, let's build it into the system. Let's not rely on this third party. So, you know, we were up against the deadline and it was... The question was posed to me is, can we get this done in a week? And I said, no, I can't do a full Stripe integration and rollout within the week and test it with what we have. But my immediate response is, what we can do is this. Mm-hmm. I can make a Stripe payment form so that they can add a payment method. And then I can show you how to manually charge their cards within the Stripe dashboard. So I was able to provide an option, or we can wait an extra week on the back of that. And I can build the option completely automated the way that you like. And we ended up going with the option of collecting the card securely through the Stripe form and then just manually charging them on the back end and not delaying the launch. But I think that's an example of providing an option. It's like, here's the way to manually charge the cards that is an option for you to get this live, you know, instead of just having the excuse of, nope, you just can't do it. And it's like, that's limiting. Let's find a way to make it happen. That's the part of what's fun about being a programmer is like, solving problems in interesting ways, whether that's with code or not. I feel like we have especially in my context, I feel like I have so many interesting business challenges to solve. And there's all kinds of ways to solve them. And sometimes that's a little bit of human labor, especially in the context of a startup. It's like, hey, we want to do this one thing for this small set of users. Sometimes it's just a matter of manually doing something, you know, manually creating coupons in Stripe or figuring out a more interesting way to solve it, you know, with a Google Sheets and an if this, then that, to just hack it together to get the MVP out. And I feel like, especially in startups, it's hard. It's easy to feel stuck. Like you don't have enough funding. You don't have enough time. You can't make anything happen. It's like, don't provide excuses, like provide an option, figure out a way to make it happen.
You know, the funny thing is too, is that the result might actually be the same, but these are sort of like soft skills that you have to have of, you know, giving your client like these options or like just explaining things better and like being better at communicating, because you might have these options in the back of your head and you might just be sitting there thinking like, oh, well, we can't do a full Stripe rollout, but we can do these other forms. But if you don't communicate that and you just say like, I can't do that, then it's like, okay, cool. So like, what can we do? You know, you don't, it's just sort of like the way that you phrase it and being socially aware of how people are responding to that and having these soft skills to be able to understand that people like options. And, you know, the authors even have this like nice little challenge at the end of this section to like make you think about it. And what they say is, personally, like, how do you react when you are at the bank or you're at a mechanic or you're at like a grocery store and they come to you with a lame excuse? Like, what do you think about them as a person and what do you think about their company as a result of this excuse? And it just made me think, like, take a step back from, you know, like being a developer, because, you know, we all have our fair share of excuses. But how many times are you like at a restaurant or something like that? And they're like, hey, we're out of bread, or like, we're out of whatever it is that you wanted. And they don't come to you with another option. You're just like, well, what the heck? Where's my blah, blah, blah? Like, I'm in, like, you feel like you're entitled to whatever it is that that they're supposedly supposed to be offering. But it's like, you know, when they come back to you with like, but we have these options, or like, but instead, because like we're inconveniencing you, here are, you know, your choices instead. And you're like, oh, okay, that's like pretty nice of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like mechanics are the biggest one of this, which is just like, well, I can't fix it. Or I literally was just wanted to have my transmission was making this crazy noise. And I tried to take my car to a mechanic, just the transmission shop, like literally this big sign transmission shop. And I pull up and I'm like, hey, can you take a look at my transmission? He's like, what's wrong with it? And I respond with, I have no idea.
That's why I'm here.
I'm a software developer. That's why I'm coming to you. Like, I'm so not mechanical. It's like making a bunch of noise. I have no idea. He's like, well, I'd have to take a look at it. I said, great. Like, can you take a look at it? He said, no, I'm busy. No, like, come back tomorrow or let's schedule a day. Like, no options. It's just a bunch of excuses that don't make any sense. It's like, I can only imagine if I treated a software client like that. It's like, well, describe the bug in detail from a technical perspective, and then I'll fix the bug.
Okay, yeah. So let's move on to tip number four. So tip three was provide options, don't make lame excuses. Tip four is don't leave broken windows. And that is super metaphorical, but I absolutely love this one because it makes me feel guilty about my own code, because just recently I was like, shit, I'm leaving broken windows everywhere. But tip four about not leaving broken windows is about software entropy or software rot. And it originates from this broken window theory. So there was like a study that was done, like a psychological study, where they concluded that, like, given like a city, because they wanted to compare cities that were left in like ruins, you know, like really run down and like, I don't know if I should say, like, ghetto cities, for lack of better words, versus like well-kept cities. What was like the breaking point like between them? Like, why did one shift to the other? And so what they concluded was that one broken window left unrepaired for any substantial length of time instills the inhabitants of the building a sense of abandonment. So, you know, another window gets broken, people start littering, graffiti appears. And so this sort of like ups the crime rate because of like one broken window. And in fact, because of this, you know, police departments in New York and other major cities have actually like cracked down on like just the small things in order to keep like the big stuff out. So it's just like literally preventing and like boarding up that one broken window so that it doesn't feel abandoned. And so that people don't feel like, oh crap, well, whatever, I can just like litter. And like, okay, well, if it's all littered, then who cares if like there's graffiti on it? And then like it just escalates and snowballs into this big thing.
They did it too, which I thought was super interesting. They did it with cars, mm-hmm. and they left two cars in similar neighborhoods, and they've done this again and again. And one car that's, you know, perfectly fine and the same make and model of car, one with a cracked window, mm-hmm. so a broken window in one car, and one that's just no broken windows. It's fine. And the car with the broken windows in one case was turned upside down and stripped of its tires within 6 hours, where the other was 3 weeks untouched.
Oh my God.
But it's so true in software. If I run my test suite and one's failing, I'm like 1,000 times more likely to let a second test start failing mm-hmm. before pushing that code up. It's like, yeah, whatever. That one's failing. I kind of know why. It's fine. But if there's every time I leave all my test suite all green every single time, it's a lot easier to maintain. This happens in my house too. Like, we'll have one dish in the sink. And I'm funny. So much more likely to leave another dish in the sink. But if there's no dishes in the sink, I am washing that dish and I'm putting it right away immediately.
I love that. It's like, don't leave broken windows. Don't leave one dirty dish. And because, like, if you think about the opposite scenario, imagine you're jumping into a new code base that's absolutely pristine, 100% test coverage. You run the test suite and it's blazing fast. Like, you don't want to be the guy that submits a PR with one failing test. Like, you don't want to be the one that fucks everything up. Like, you want to keep things yeah. pristine when you're entering into that, like, heavenly bliss of, like, perfection.
So practically, what does this look like and how do we prevent it, though? Like, I love this idea and we all want to have great quality and we don't want to have this software rot, but what are some tips that we can do to prevent this?
Okay, that's a good question. And I was just thinking about this earlier. When I was very guilty of leaving broken windows everywhere. So I was shipping a new feature in this app that I'm working on for work. And, you know, there's timelines and there's like deadlines. And so with the nature of React components, it's very easy to have a component that's hundreds of lines long because you're just like, screw it. You know what? I'll break these down into smaller composable components that are a lot easier to test. I'll do that later. But like for now, I just want to get something on the screen and, you know, fuck the test. I just want to get something on the screen, something that works, and just to prove that, like, this concept is doable. And, you know, then we'll ship something, then we'll push it to the beta server, and then we'll eventually merge it when, you know, the time comes. And then that's exactly what I did. And then now I found myself with, like, and that's just, like, one little broken window is, like, not breaking out, like, React components into multiple easier-to-test components. Because now I have, like, I think I got it down to like 700 lines, but at one point I was in four digits, but I had like a 600, 700 like line component, massive component, which should be broken down into multiple components. And there's like very little test coverage on it. And it all started because when I first started writing this thing, I was like leaving broken windows everywhere. I was like, screw it. I'll just tack on another component. I'll just like keep it in this file. Forget it. I'll just like keep writing functions. I'll keep writing instance methods on this class. Like, screw it. And then before you know it, it's like super, super unmaintainable. And it just like snowballs into this like larger, unmanageable mess. And so that's the first thing I thought of was like, God, I need to start approaching my approach better. And the only reason I was doing that was because I was like, oh, you know, there's a time, you know, I was making excuses. I was saying like, oh, there's a time crunch. I just want to get something on the screen. Like, I just want to ship something. I want to be fast. And in a way, like, that's also like neglecting the craft because like, it's like, oh, I don't care about it. I'll just like get it done. And it's really yeah. easy to just fall into that trap of like, I'll just get it done. Screw it.
It's hard though, because I think some of what you're describing is essential, which is just kind of exploring and getting something on the screen and starting playing with the data and seeing what happens. Mm-hmm. So in a practical sense, one thing that I've started doing is when I create a new branch for a feature, the first branch I make will be called something like brainstorm or mockup. Mm-hmm. And I just like make it work. I kind of scaffold it out. I don't really think through the code quality. It's a lot of pseudocode. It's a lot of filler stuff. And then when I actually go to create the feature, so then that's what I screen cap, that's what I show the client, that's kind of what I get demo. So it's more of a mock-up. Mm-hmm. And then when I go to actually build it out, I stop and I go, okay, I nuke that branch completely. I don't pull code in from it, but I learn a lot of lessons from getting something on the screen, making something clickable, uh-huh. starting to get the data on the screen. So I think that is important to do, but I think it's important to like have a design phase and then a build phase where you're like thinking about the craftsmanship, because kind of what you're describing is that you were building this sketch, but then it just like kept going and then it just kind of shipped.
Yeah.
And that's what we want to prevent as developers, that sketch phase like evolves into an engineering phase, because that's not engineering. That's just kind of sketching and designing, which is important. So it's like, you don't want to like go into a project with too much engineering behind it, because it takes so long to get the thought out of your head, mm-hmm. get something on screen. So I don't feel like you could always get the most natural design that way. I mean, the other two super practical ways to not leave broken windows is, of course, test coverage. Get tests written, do it slowly, start it now, start test. And the second thing is linting. That's been huge for me. Like, throwing prettier JS has made my JavaScript so beautiful, and it helps you maintain some of that stuff. You know, it's a little robot that comes along and comments on your code and cleans it up and makes sure that it's nice. But there's RuboCop for Ruby. Like, every framework has got these linters that help you, whether or not they do it automatically or whether it guides you to have better code quality. I feel like that's a huge help. It's been a huge help for me, just having better quality and caring and, you know, continuing to learn and refine that syntax of my code.
Yeah. So, like, in a way, you know, having a linter and having RuboCop and having prettier is sort of like preventing broken windows from even happening, which is nice.
Yeah, it is. It's super nice. And there's like other things like Circle CI and Hound, and there's all kinds of services that do that. But you don't need something like that. You can just like pay attention and don't leave the broken windows. I feel like we all know where we leave them and when. The last thing I'll say on this tip four before I jump into the next one is, I really like how Basecamp handles some of this that we've been talking about. Basically, they created Ruby on Rails. They have Basecamp, the project management system. If you're in software development, you probably know who they are. They work in these 6-week sprints, and they have a feature that they want to ship, but they never compromise on their sprint, on their test coverage, or on their code quality. They compromise on the scope of the feature.
Interesting.
So if they wanted this certain, you know, new feature to ship, that is, you know, rich text editing on a certain kind of post, and they wanted bullet points, and they wanted numbers, and they wanted image embeds and all these different features, when they're getting down to the wire and they're seeing the scope create, they're seeing the time and what they have left to be able to develop this feature come up, they never will compromise their test coverage, or they never will compromise the code quality. They'll say, okay, we're shipping less, and we're going to do it with the same level of quality. And more, I've been really pushing clients to let me do that. It's like, you wanted to ship this for this price, and instead of compromising the way that I ship it and implement it, more and more I'm saying, we're going to do these three things instead of five, or we're going to have to increase the scope of the project. And they're fine with it because they want to build quality at this point. Now that's like, it's gone past the scrappy kind of hacking together for startup. Like, we want to build maintainable and shippable software. So I think a way to prevent broken windows is, when you're getting down to the wire, you're trying to care about your craft, I think don't compromise the way that you build once you kind of have a bar of quality on a project. Maybe compromise what it is that you're building. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of building three rooms onto the house, build one with the same quality that you can.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, like, you might hit the scope, but you might be leaving broken windows everywhere, and, you know, the software debt, or the tech debt rather, is not something that's fun to deal with later on.
Yeah, and we've talked about that. So there's a time and a place for technical debt, and we've talked about that. So tip five, and I love this one, is be a catalyst for change.
Cool.
So I'm going to read a quick story here that introduced this concept. I don't know where this story has come. I think it was from World War I is the time frame on the story, right? Yeah,
I think
it's World War I. Yeah. So here's the quote. The soldiers returning home from war were hungry. When they saw the village, their spirits lifted. They were sure the villagers would give them a meal. But when they got there, they found the doors locked and the windows closed. After many years of war, the villagers were short of food and hoarded what they have. Undeterred, the soldiers boiled a pot of water and carefully placed three stones into it. The amazed villagers came out to watch. "This is stone soup," the soldiers explained. "Is that all you put in it?" asked the villagers. "Absolutely. Although some say it tastes even better with a few carrots." A villager ran off, returning in no time with a basket of carrots from his hoard. A couple of minutes later, the villagers again asked, "Is that..." "Well," the soldier says, "a couple of potatoes would give it body." Off ran another villager. And more, so that's the end of the quote, but more and more, the villagers keep asking, like, "Well, what else could we add? What else could we add?" And by the time that they're done, they have this amazing vegetable soup that they share with everyone in the village. So the idea is that instead of being deterred or discouraged or frustrated that they couldn't get vegetables and food from these villagers, they did what they could, which was put stones in a pot of water and start to boiling them. And that action on their part was a catalyst for change that inspired everybody to, like, participate. And, like, I love this note that JP put here. He said, so the tip is, be a catalyst for change. And he said, or gradual deception and you can get what you want.
It's funny. I mean, that's kind of what it is. Is like, maybe deception is kind of like a harsh word for it, but you kind
of... It's a little strong, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to phrase things and give things context in such a way that people will be more willing to contribute, rather.
Yeah. And I just love the idea of just being the catalyst for change in a project and being the one to start. And I see this, it's huge with my clients. I used to estimate everything and every once in a while maybe do mockups when I felt like it was needed. And now I make interactive mockups almost every time. And the amount of buy-in that I get from clients and the sales that I make is so much higher because they totally own the vision and understand what I'm wanting to build. And like building a little HTML clickable thing is not that hard. And it goes such a long way to be that catalyst for what you're wanting to build for a client, whether internal or external. I feel like if you did this in a company too, it's like spend 20 minutes of your own time or an hour of company time just like mocking something up that makes it there. Do what you can. Like you might not have approval for that total redesign right now, but redesign one screen and see what they say. You know, redesign one thing, write one test in a place with no test coverage. Be that first person who starts and be that catalyst for that change.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to also sell like writing tests and having good test coverage to someone who's maybe not technical, maybe someone who's a domain expert or some like a C-level exec that just like wants to ship. But it's like maybe you reference a time when there was like a bug and that really slowed things down. And so you write one test and then you sort of frame it like, oh, but imagine if we had a bunch of tests. And then it becomes like this whole thing of like, oh, shoot. Well, now we can ship confidently and not ever have to worry about ever having downtime or ever having bugs.
And actually, with this client, like I started with 40% code coverage. Mm-hmm. Like that's what I quoted and that's what I did with the client. And then after that, it's like, yeah, well, this change was so much easier because of this test coverage in this area. Mm-hmm. And it was like more and more. They're like, how do we get more coverage? And they were asking me, how do I get more test coverage? How do we do that? And that's oftentimes something that's so hard to sell.
Uh-huh.
So tip six was remember the big picture.
Yeah, so so tip six it's more about soup, really. And it talks about, there's this idea that if you put a frog in boiling water, it's going to jump right out and you're not going to be able to cook the frog. But if you put the frog in like cold water, or like lukewarm water, and then slowly turn up the heat until it's boiling, they won't notice and they'll get cooked. And so basically what this tip is saying is like, don't be the frog, you know. Be aware of your surroundings and remember the big picture, like remember what's around you and not just like, I don't know. And don't be like susceptible to just like accepting gradual change without seeing the bigger picture. I'm using a definition to define the definition. do you have any good insight on remembering the big picture?
You know, I think it's a lot like don't leaving broken windows and a lot like the stone cutter who remembers the cathedral. I think it has a lot of the other tips in it, which is like, don't let that entropy creep up on you, that software rot creep up on you. Mm-hmm. And even to some degree, don't allow yourself to just become complacent. You know,
right.
Don't let yourself be that frog who slowly gets boiled. All right. So tip seven is make quality a requirements issue. There will be always trade-offs, when to ship. And this is like kind of what we're talking about with Basecamp, of how they will compromise the amount of things that they're shipping. So this is the quote from the book. Great software today is often preferable than perfect software tomorrow. If you give your users something to play with early, their feedback will often lead you to a better eventual solution.
Nice. Yeah, that's exactly what we were talking about with Basecamp. And there's this nice little challenge too, this little thought experiment or thought challenge that we get presented with. And I think this is going to be cool to talk about. So the challenge is, look at some software you use. Can you find evidence that companies are comfortable shipping software they know is not perfect? And as a user, would you rather wait for them to iron out all the bugs? Would you rather have complex software and accept some bugs? Or would you rather have really, really simple software with very, very, very few defects? And that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. And it's like, do companies ship software that's like buggy? Yeah, I mean, look at Apple. Look at iOS and Mac OS. There's always things that are breaking. But I think they get to a point where they're like, yeah, we can ship it.
Yeah. I think this happens a lot on the web too. Like, I feel like I run into corners of applications like Google Docs or Yelp that it's like, oh, like I just have to like quit Chrome and relaunch it. And it's like, try it a different way, maybe hack the URL a bit. It's like, oh, okay, now it's working the way that I'm expecting it to. I think that there's nothing wrong with perfect software tomorrow, or great software today. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer on mm-hmm. what the option is here, but I do think that quality needs to be a requirements issue. And it's like, oftentimes I talk with clients when starting up a new project and I'm like, I could build this application for as little as $8,000 or as much as $80,000. Mm-hmm. Like genuinely, I could build it within that range. I could probably go to $800,000 depending on what you want to build. But it's a matter of what kind of quality and craftsmanship do you want to be taken? Like, what are the priorities right now? And essentially, the question I'm asking is, how much technical debt do you want to take on right now? How important is it to get to market now versus building something that's sustainable and quality? And finding that balance is really a challenge, especially when the people you're working with are not necessarily very technical. It's already hard when everyone's technical to come to agreement on that and define that, what that means. But especially when someone's non-technical, it's like, well, I don't care. I just want it to render on the page. But it's like, oof, you're making an investment here in software, and there's lots of different ways that you can invest in it.
Yeah, and I'm trying to put myself into, you know, a regular user's shoes and thinking like, what kind of software would I prefer? Like fewer features and like no bugs, or like a ton of features and you know, some bugs? But I don't, you're right. Like there's no answer to that, because I'm my own person. Like everyone's different. Like some people might prefer, you know, tons and tons of features, and you know, those early adopters might be willing, they don't care about the bugs. Like they're willing to live with it. It's just like part of what they accept. Isn't there like a game called, it's, I don't know, Fortnite or like one of those, or there's a game that's like blowing up right now.
Yeah, Fortnite's a big one right now. I haven't played it, but I keep hearing about it everywhere.
It's either Fortnite or PUBG. I think it might be PUBG. I don't know anything about it. I don't play video games, but my coworkers were telling me about it. And I asked my boss to like describe it. And he was like, it's this and this and this, and it's this whole game. But the problem is that it's like super buggy, and like things don't work, and the map's like whatever. And like a lot of times, like things just don't work. And I was like, well, why the hell do you put up with it? And he's like, well, dude, it's really because it's just, it's so different, and it's like really innovative. But the crazy thing to me is that like they put up with it, and they spend hours on end like playing this video game that like kind of works. So that's that was an interesting thing to me, because like imagine if that game had fewer features and wasn't as rich in features, but like it was perfect. You know, they might not have as big of a success as it is. So I think that's kind of an interesting to think about. But yeah, there's always trade-offs.
Yeah, I just think it's important to like try to define that and get onto it, because like for me as a person, I would way rather have simpler software that's rock solid mm-hmm. than like all types of options and have less. But it's like, you might be different. Your client might be different. Your internal team might be different. The bar might be different. So it's just really make it a requirements issue. That's the tip here. Tip 7, make quality requirements issue.
Yeah.
What's the next one, JP?
Okay, so this one, I really like this one. So tip 8 is invest regularly in your knowledge portfolio. And so this was it compared your knowledge portfolio a lot to like an investment portfolio. And so you have to think of your knowledge as like an expiring asset. And so here are like the tips that like apply to both your like knowledge investments.
Before we jump into the tips though, like what is an expiring asset? And this like rocked my brain for a second. He's like, oh, an expiring asset would be like a warehouse full of bananas. Like there is a fixed expiration date on that warehouse of bananas. It has a lot of value mm-hmm. right now, but that investment that you've made in that warehouse of bananas is quickly expiring. And it's easy to forget that as a developer. Like, I feel like I've built all these skills, and a lot of the soft skills or more like fundamental understandings of domain design and things do carry from language to language. But like, I can't be guaranteed that the language I'm writing today is going to be here even a year from today.
Exactly.
It could be completely gone overnight. So what are the tips within?
Yeah. So like just what you said, it's like, even like I'm a React developer right now, but who knows in 2 years, like React might not, it's not that it's going to not exist, but I mean like think about like Backbone and Ember. It's like, you know, those were once upon a time pretty popular. So he compares like your knowledge portfolio to like an investment portfolio, and these tips can be applied the same way. So invest regularly, diversify. So, you know, don't be like a one-trick pony. Balance your portfolio regularly between high-risk and high-reward investments. Buy low and sell high. So obviously buying low and selling high is like, it's kind of like a guess. Like you don't know if like Vue.js is going to be the next big thing, but you buy low into it and like, you know, the payoff is huge. And review and rebalance periodically. So the same, like all of these things can be applied to like your knowledge portfolio. So, you know, you have to diversify yourself. The more technologies you're comfortable with, like later on down the road, the easier it will be for you to adjust. And so the authors go a little more specific and talk about some things you can do to keep current with your knowledge portfolio. And so,
yeah, like there's like straight up action points of what you can do to do some of the things. Before we get into that, I would love to talk a little bit about buying low and selling high for knowledge, because that's such an interesting concept. So buying low and selling high for a stock is like, ideally you can invest in Apple 10 years ago when Apple stock was $300 and now Apple stock is worth $1,600 a share. So that's the idea. But at the time it was a really high risk to invest into Apple stock. And I feel like that would be the same thing for a lot of different languages and frameworks out there right now. It's like, as of right now, from a investment standpoint, React is very expensive, meaning like everybody's buying into it. Everybody wants to buy into React. Me learning it now when I'm going through some different courses and things to get better at React and understanding it better. Like, I'm buying when everybody else is getting in on it. But UJP, you were learning React about a year and a half ago or so. And it's like, you were right there as this bubble has hit, being an expert in React. You are so hot in the job market and you were able to land your great job that you were with that React skills because you bought low in investing into that skill set. It's hard to do because there's always so many different technologies. And I feel like I have, like when I first started learning to code, I invested really heavily in learning Python. That skill is like totally out of my brain now. And it was useless to me as wanting to be a CRUD web developer. Like I could have invested more into some different Python frameworks and things like that. But like where I was as a developer and learning the Python language wasn't the best choice for me. So I spent 3.5-4 months learning Python. I never even got to a framework and I never really even got something to show up in a browser because I was never able to do it. And the second that I started investing in Rails, this is what, 4 or 5 years ago now, I was like, oh shit, like this is what I should have been spending my time with because like I can get something on the screen. This is more the language that is, it's more natural to me. Like this is the way that I want to speak in. This is the way that works for me. It just was a fit. Not that there's anything wrong with Python if you're a Python developer. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't my language of choice. So I think that it's hard to know what are the things to invest in. So here's my question to you, JP. What new, hot new languages are you looking at and why? And what do you think you'll be buying into in the coming year or so?
Man, it's just so hard because there's so many things. I think Elixir and Phoenix, although it's not like those are super, super new. They're relatively new. There's not that many books on them. But I think Elixir and Phoenix, I don't know that they're going to, you know, be as hot as React is now because like the JavaScript, you know, train is like full force right now. But I think Elixir and Phoenix are pretty cool. But I don't know that they're the next like Bitcoin or that they're the next like, oh man, I wish I invested early in that. But yeah, that's a good question. I think JavaScript right now in general, but it's hard to say because it's funny that you point out like I invested early in React, which is kind of true because at that point it was like Angular and React were kind of like tied. Oh, yeah. And I was like, do you go Angular and Ionic or do you go React and React Native? And I was like, I don't know, React Native's kind of cool. And I just went with it.
Yeah, for sure. And it was very, I feel like at the time that you started, Angular was a little bit more of a winner and like easier to get started. The bar was a lot lower to like get something on the screen with Angular back then, I feel like. Yeah, it's tough. And I, as a, you know, an investor in my knowledge, I am not diversified. Like I am very strictly a Rails developer and only in the last year or so have become better with JavaScript. And I'm starting to a little bit buy low and seeing the benefit of just building out on Stimulus right now because it's like a brand new, but it's within the Rails framework, but it's a brand new JavaScript framework within Rails. But it's fun to be part of an early community and like issues get solved so quick and like figuring it out with a few other web developers. And like, I remember like I solved one little thing in the Stimulus framework within Rails and like a week later, you sent me a video link of a Stimulus thing. And I was like, ooh, I already solved this. And so it was like a Railscast. No, it wasn't Railscast. It was the other guy. I forgot who. Go Rails. Yeah. You sent me a Go Rails video on Stimulus. And I was like, dude, I already figured this out on my own, which was kind of cool to like be a part of a small group of people who know about a technology early, even though that's like a tiny, tiny sliver. But I'm seeing the value of it. And I'm committing now, even on the podcast, to like be more open to learning different languages and be more open to investing in the software, knowing that I could totally go this route and learn this. Like you could have invested all that time in React and it could have gone nowhere for you, unfortunately. And that's unfortunately what it's like investing in this knowledge portfolio. Sometimes you have high risk investments.
Yeah. And so one of my picks is actually going to be a YouTube video, but there's this cool video by a guy who's big in the JavaScript community and he goes by, like, I think MPJ. But he has this video called Staying Relevant as a Programmer. And basically what it boils down to is how can you stay on top of your knowledge portfolio? And like, how can you keep that up to date without really making big risks and having, you know, high risk, high reward? But there's like things you can do, and I'll get to this when we get to the picks, but there's things you can do to make sure that you stay relevant and not like out of date. Because, you know, in the world where there's like, I think as we've recorded this podcast, 5 different JavaScript frameworks probably came out. But yeah, so there's always that struggle of what do I learn and how do I stay relevant? And like, what's the point of even learning if by the time I like am good enough to sell myself to be able to, you know, use this framework, it's not even going to be popular anymore. It's like no one's going to even be using it. So like, there's always that question lingering in the back of your head when you're trying to pick up a new framework or a new language. Yeah.
So within this tip 8, the tip is invest regularly in your knowledge portfolio. There were some kind of goals and action steps. You want to walk us through those?
Yeah. So these are just 8 quick things. So 1, learn at least 1 new language every year, because different languages solve the same problems in different ways. And it's a nice way to really expand your thinking. And so that's really cool. I think I'm trying to pick up Java just so I can go back to the basics. Okay, so 2, read a technical book every quarter. After you've mastered the technologies you're currently using, branch out and study some that don't relate to your project. So, you know, if you're all about the relational databases, pick up a Mongo book just to see what all the hubbub's about. You know, just you might not even ever use that, but like just to see how people are solving the same problems in much different ways can be very eye-opening. Okay, so 3, read non-technical books, because who uses software? People. And sometimes you need to be able to have soft skills to also like understand how people work. So don't like always be behind a computer, you know. 4, take classes, you know, just really just expand on your knowledge. 5, participate in local user groups. And I think since this book was written in 1999, we can translate that to
meetups.
To go to meetups. Yeah, like network, yeah, meet people. Absolutely. Talk to people in the same space. 6, experiment with different environments. You know, maybe it's Windows, Ubuntu, Linux, things like that. If you're a Mac person, like venture out, just like you might not ever use any of these environments ever, but just see like how different environments approach the same things.
I would even throw in iOS versus Android,
yeah,
just because it's a different software approach. And like there's nuances of software design that you can pick up.
Yeah. And I mean, like what makes an app feel like an app in iOS might not feel the same way in Android, just even like based on user interactions. And that goes into whole like UX Absolutely. Stuff, but also it, you know, you're touching that code too as a software developer. So 7, stay current, obviously. And 8, get wired. And so I interpret this as like, follow big players in the space. Like if you're a Rails guy, follow DHH on Twitter, you know? If you're big into like JavaScript and React, you know, like follow Dan Abramov on Twitter too. Like see what these guys are talking about. Like see, like understand like what it is that they like go through on a daily basis, basically.
I love this quote that closes out this whole tip, this tip 8 of invest regularly in your knowledge portfolio. And the quote was, it doesn't matter whether you ever use any of these technologies on a project or even whether or not you put them on your resume. The process of learning will expand your thinking, opening you to new possibilities and new ways of doing things.
I love that.
Totally true.
I love awesome. That. All right.
Tip 9, critically analyze what you read and hear. So don't get swayed by the hype. You have a quote here. I'm looking at you, Create React App.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about like, you know, critically analyze what you read and hear. Like, so be like a critical thinker. Don't just accept things. And the reason I say I'm looking at you, Create React App, is because if you've ever like dabbled with React, you know that Create React App is like the de facto no configuration setup for bootstrapping a React app. It has like all the Babel configuration, all the Webpack configuration. Don't have to worry about anything. And I was at JSLA just the other week, and I was talking to, you know, another JavaScript developer, and I had mentioned like offhand, it's like, yeah, I was like, yeah, isn't it crazy how like before everything used to be all over the place, and then Create React App came out, and now it's like the best thing. It's like the best like configuration set up for like a React application. And then this guy, he challenged me and he said, well, it's the best marketed one. And I was like, damn, that's true. Like there might actually be better stuff out there, but it's just like, I've just accepted because like, it's like kind of, it's like released by Facebook. And like, if you want to bootstrap a Facebook or like a React application, like the instructions on like React docs say just like use Create React App. And here I am like, yeah, okay, I'll accept it. But like, who knows? Like there might be much better tooling for making a React application with like test configuration set up and like Webpack and Babel and all this other stuff. But sometimes you have to like take a deeper look at what it is you're accepting. Like maybe it is the best thing, but you won't know that unless you discover, like go out and try to discover other things and see like maybe like the GitHub repo with only 10 stars is doing like what they're doing is like, oh, maybe that's why Create React App is like the best thing since sliced bread. But
yeah,
until you discover.
I think it's important too to critically analyze what you read in here because it may not work for you. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of taste and preference in our tools that we use and in our technologies we use. And sometimes it's easy to get caught up in like, well, this many people are using it. And I feel like DHH has a great point on this where so many people are like, oh, what's Google using? What's Facebook using to build their applications? Mm-hmm. And he's like, why do you care what they're using? Their scale, their problems they're solving are worlds different than your startup, at least for the next 3 or 4 years. Uh-huh. Like your startup doesn't have the same problems as a Facebook. Your startup doesn't have, or your company probably doesn't have 500 React developers. It probably has 1 or 5 React developers. So you don't need to write React the way that Facebook is writing React. And sometimes we look at the scale of something and the Googles and the way they're implementing things, and we think it's the right way for us. But that's insanity to think about that way. Like if you owned a little burger joint, you wouldn't make hamburgers the way McDonald's does. You wouldn't use a central distributor and freeze everything. Like you'd make shitty hamburgers. That's not what you're trying to do. You're solving completely different problems. And so part of the problem with what you read and hear sometimes is it's not for you. And you have to think about, is this even for me? Does it apply? And it reminds me, there was a recent piece, I think it was in like Esquire, it's in a weird like non-technical publication where a Twitter executive was quoted saying that Rails was, he called it play school tools. He's like, well, we couldn't solve the abuse on Twitter because we inherited a framework, a technical framework that was play school tools. And it's like,
oh,
don't blame Rails for not solving your abuse because Rails can solve the abuse. Like, it's just one of those things that like really made its way around the web because mm-hmm. he was like criticizing Ruby on Rails for being this preschool tool. And it's like, it's not for what they were at. And you can solve abuse with like, it's a non-technical person blaming something that is a sad thing to blame. But it's like, if you critically analyze that for a second, it's not a Twitter executive who understands technology saying that Rails was a bad choice for them at the time. Like that's not what's being said there. And so people conflated that and were like, oh, Rails is dead because Twitter is disowning it. It's like, no, the whole technical team at Twitter like still loves Rails and still thinks it was the right way to go. And Twitter wouldn't exist unless they had Rails to build it on in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's my little nitpick about defending Rails this week.
Yeah. So that's cool. It's like the whole fake news thing. It's like really like critically analyze what you read in here. And challenge what the norm, not necessarily to always be like a contrarian, but like think through like what you read in here. And you're right. Like, I think oftentimes people look for the cookie cutter solution. Like I am a startup founder. Like what's the right stack for me? And it's like, well, you should know that. Like, don't follow the advice blindly from like what someone said on Stack Overflow, like worked for them, you know, cause that might not work for you. Like maybe you need right. WebSockets. And so you're going to use like Node.js and Socket.io. Like, I don't know. But yeah, that's a good one. I like that one. All right. So let's jump into the last tip for this chapter. And then after we discuss a little bit, we'll go through all 10 tips again and then go through picks. So tip 10 is it's both what you say and the way you say it. So this is much about your soft skills. So this quote says, having the best ideas, the finest code, or the most pragmatic thinking is ultimately sterile unless you can communicate with other people. A good idea is an orphan without communication. So that is essentially, you know, being able to communicate effectively and being able to express your ideas. And like, A lot goes into that because it's really easy to just say things like, oh yeah, like be a good communicator and make sure that what you're trying to express is very explicit and clear. But a lot goes into that. Like, for example, you need to know your audience. You can't talk to two different people the same way and expect them to understand what you're saying. You have to understand the needs of your audience and sort of cater to that. A lot of this is like soft skills. And if you've ever read like How to Win Friends and Influence People, it's sort of like being able to empathize with people and understand where they're coming from and being able to express your ideas based on how they're going to respond to it. So yeah, just, you know, understand your audience, I think, is basically what this tip is. And a lot can go into that. And there's also like a little laundry list of how you can do things better, like how you can hone these soft skills. And so here's the list. It's know what to say, know your audience, choose your moment. Like, that's to say, like, if you want something from your boss, don't go to him at 4 p.m. like on a Friday, or don't go to him at 9 a.m. on a Monday before he's had his coffee or her coffee. So yeah. And then choose a style, like know how to deliver your message. You know, some people like just the facts, and some people like really descriptive details. So you have to like know who your audience is, and make it look good, make it pop. You know, think about like the way you present things. Imagine jumping onto a project where the README documentation was like ugly versus like documentation that's really pretty. Like, look at
Laravel. That one goes a long way, especially with non-technical people. It's like, take a quick second, make a graph, make a mock-up, you know, add a header to your text, bullet point something. It goes a really long way to communicate and get someone buy-in on what you're doing. In a lot of ways, that's boiling the rocks, you know, to call back to what we were saying.
Right. Like, so gradual deception. No, I'm kidding. okay, so yeah, so make it pop, you know, involve your audience, be a listener, like be a good listener, understand that it's not always about talking. It's always about, sometimes it's about listening. And finally, which I really, really liked and which I'm going to try to get better at, is always get back to people, you know? And this is especially true for like emails, because you might have received an email, but, you know, even just a confirmation saying like received, I'll get back to you later, is a lot, like, is worlds better than just like mentally saying like, okay, I received this email, and then not getting back to someone. Cause, you know, they're on the other end thinking like, okay, is it like stuck in drafts? Like, did this email send? Is my internet connection messed up? Like, what happened? So it's always good to be like, okay, I received it, I'm going to get to it later. Or like, your idea was noted, your issue was noted, it's now in GitHub issues, it's now in our issue tracker. Like, just little things like that are, I think, something that you don't always think about, but when you're like more cognizant of it, like for us now reading this book, it's like now easier to be like, oh, okay, like I need to make a better effort to communicate with whomever I'm talking to, and I need to make a better effort to like make sure that my message is being communicated properly given the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So tip one was care about your craft. Two, think about your work. Never run on autopilot. Three, provide options. Don't make lame excuses. Four, don't leave broken windows. Five, be a catalyst for change. Six, remember the big picture. Seven, make quality a requirements issue. Eight, invest regularly into your knowledge portfolio. Nine, critically analyze what you read and hear. 10, it's both what you say and the way you say it. And that concludes chapter one and the intro of our new book, The Pragmatic Programmer. We are super excited to jump into this one, and we will see you next week for chapter two, A Pragmatic Approach. But before we close out, we've got some picks. JP, what do you got for us this week?
Okay, so I have it's a YouTube video. We'll link it in the show notes, and it's basically called Staying Relevant as a Programmer. But as a little spoiler, the video basically talks about honing in the essentials and going back to the basics of programming, because those essentials, you know, like looping, iteration, object orientation, like the basics, those have stood the test of time. And if you understand those like really, really well, it doesn't matter what JavaScript framework you're trying to pick up, you know, because you'll just be able to pick up the next one and it won't be a big deal. You won't have to worry about your knowledge being an expiring asset, because like the greatest thing that you can have is knowledge that doesn't expire. And what kind of knowledge doesn't expire? You know, fundamental programming. And so that's my little spiel.
I think the other one people look over as developers too is the fundamentals of design. And that's another one that's like, beyond like what's in style, there's some fundamentals of design that are really important to think about when implementing not only front-end design, but from like a UX perspective of how you're communicating. So I couldn't agree more, and I definitely will check out that video. That sounds awesome.
Cool. What's your pick?
My pick comes from all places of... It comes from Kim Kardashian.
Oh, God.
And I don't know when I saw this on an interview, but I adopted her method of text message management. And it has brought my stress level down so much. So this is what the pick was. And it was like on an interview, something, my wife was watching something or something. And she's just like, every night before I go to bed, I delete every text message thread that's in my phone.
Interesting.
She clears the inbox of text message threads. And I have been doing this, and it's so awesome because there's no unread on an iPhone. Uh-huh. And it's sometimes a client will text me something at noon and I'm on another client call and I'll read it, but then I won't do anything about it in that moment. And it's so easy for things to get lost in text message threads. So what I literally do every night is I delete every single text message thread I had. And it does two things. One, it forces me to take action on an item. So before I delete it, if I was sent an address, I have to go add it to my address book. If I was set a login for a server, I got to go add it to my 1Password. You know, if I was sent an image that someone I have to reference for a design from a client, I'm going to go add that to the repository before I delete that thread. Otherwise, it won't be there. And two, I have 100% confidence that everything has been followed up on and I'm getting back to everybody, trying to always respond, which is a tip that was in here in this document, in this quote, because I feel like, especially as a freelancer, you get hit from all sides. You get emails, you get calls, you get texts, you get Twitter DMs, like it's all over the place. And to me, to have the sanity of knowing I'm at quote unquote inbox zero on my text messaging threads is huge. It's so nice. And it's like, now I don't have my brother sitting and waiting 3 days that I didn't text him back. And I'm a lot better at texting people back.
Nice. So that's my pick. Wow. I like that. That's pretty insightful. I might have to start doing that. That wraps up our episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you guys next time.